This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm going to do something right now that you're not supposed to do in my business. I'm going to be silent. So I want you to take the next 5 seconds or so to see where your mind wanders and see if you can just be in this brief moment. All right, now, come on back. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley believes that this moment and moments like this can actually put us on a path to a healthier life. He specializes in mindfulness and helping people discover the powerful connection between their emotions and their bodies. Dr. Brantley is founder of Duke's Integrative Medicine Program, and he heads the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, and he's with me in the studio today. Jeffrey Brantley, welcome to the program. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I actually am one of the many co-founding faculty. I'm not the individual that founded Duke Integrative Medicine. There were many of us involved and still are. I did found the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, though.
Well, let's talk about that and this term mindfulness. What do you mean?
Okay, mindfulness is, it's got a lot of publicity these days. It refers, as I understand it, to a basic human capacity for knowing in this moment. And I just want a bow of appreciation to you for inviting people to take 5 seconds at the beginning. That pause is crucial to experiencing our natural capacity for awareness and for being present. So mindfulness is the knowing of what's here. It's not thinking about it. It's actually the part of us that can even know what we're thinking and when we're thinking it.
So it might have been good for me to ask everybody in that 5 seconds to think back, where did your mind go? Would that be helpful? Is that what I'm trying to do?
It's kind of a matter, I think, of simply being willing to notice what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, it's as easy as that, but not always as simple as that, but not always easy. So a person might notice their mind is racing. They might notice their body is hungry this time of day, or they might notice any number of things, but it's the noticing, the awareness that we have built in as humans, and it can be cultivated systematically. And that's kind of what some of the topics, you know, we might be talking about.
Why would that be important?
Well, one of the basic reasons it's important is, let me just, years ago I wrote a piece about something to the effect, have you ever been eating an ice cream cone and looked down and realized it was the ice cream was gone, and you wondered who ate your ice cream? Well, you had a sticky napkin in your hand, and there was some evidence maybe you did it, but you don't remember eating it.
Yeah.
You know, our mind takes us away. It goes to the future, the past, and we actually miss the moments of our life. So a very basic value or benefit for practicing mindfulness is really about practicing being present for our life.
But again, I'm going to press you on that to see why that's important. I mean, one of the things that defines us and distinguishes us as humans is our ability to project ourselves into the future, what's going to happen tomorrow, whether or not I get into school, whether or not I get the classes I registered for, and what we did in the past. Oh, I shouldn't have eaten that ice cream. Not all of it anyway. I mean, all of that is what distinguishes us as humans. That's what we do. How does noticing how all of that's flying around our heads in any given moment while, in fact, we're driving the kids to school or whatever it is we're doing?
Yes. Well, you know, it's a good question. We are capable as humans for all of that executive cognition that you talked about. You use fancy language about it. And, you know, what happens to me and what a lot of people tell me in our stress reduction classes is that they get hijacked more often than they want to be by that capacity to project into the future, to worry about things, to remember the past, to blame themselves and all that stuff. And so it's not about the thinking and all that planning and whatnot is a good thing. But when it becomes kind of driving us and we can't get free of it, that's when we run into trouble.
Particularly when we're not aware of it and noticing it. So that if you sit down to make a decision, then you think I'm in control and don't realize how much of the narrative has already been written by these stories that you've been telling yourself when you weren't thinking about it, I guess.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, psychotherapists help people discern their stories, the personal narrative, very important work. It's also possible in fact, psychotherapists often send patients to our program to help each person develop their own skills in self-awareness, which includes skills of being aware of the inner narrative and the thought trains that are happening.
So tell us, what's the relationship between this and Duke Integrative Medicine? How does Duke Integrative Medicine work? Maybe I should start there.
Oh, right.
There.
Very good question. Okay. So, you know, back in the day when we, myself and others, were thinking about our disappointment with the health system and what could be better, we recognized, and we had different specialists involved, we recognized that self-awareness in individuals is crucial to their trajectory of health and healing, that individuals can be their own best advocate for the choices they make and how they react to things and all of that. So we, fortunately, there's a national model for cultivating mindfulness or non-judging awareness, which is called mindfulness-based stress reduction. So we envisioned a model of health that is whole person-centered, not diagnostically focused, that empowers and sees the power of each person, and that believes that education and particularly training and awareness will empower each person to be the single most important factor in their health. So at the very core of our model is you, and at the core around you is mindfulness, and everything else follows from that. So there's lifestyle assessment and recommendations and partnerships like with nutrition and exercise and that. And there's also the availability at Duke Integrative Medicine for expert interventions from a variety of evidence-based paradigms, Western allopathic medicine, of course, but also something like acupuncture and Chinese medicine.
What have you – I know you've been practicing mindfulness for many years. What has it done for you?
Oh, gosh. In short, I think I probably would be not even be here if it weren't for mindfulness. And one thing, it's enabled me to have this interview with you and your listeners. And I'm serious about that.
What do you mean? You mean there was a time when you were too shy? You wouldn't have been able to
oh,
to
no, heck, shyness. I'm talking about being alive.
Oh, all right.
You know, I had, like many of my peers in college and medical school, developed some bad habits for managing my stress and a lot of ignorance, really, about my inner narratives and the way I talk to myself about the world. I didn't have much of an ability to relax and be present. And the meditation has helped me in all those ways. And I'm very confident that I would have had much more serious, probably health problems and less effective, happy life and relationships. I might not even have been alive today.
You were trained as a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, and now you're practicing psychiatry. Why? What led you to meditation? This is sort of off the track a bit.
Yes.
Isn't it for you?
Well, it's an interesting, you know, the invisible ones, or grace descends, or whatever your language is around faith and that. But, you know, when I was a medical student at UNC, I was interested. I saw an ad for transcendental meditation, which is bit different from mindfulness, but there's some commonalities, some similarities. And I noticed when I did the TM, my blood pressure came down. This was like 1976. That really got my attention because I had a borderline hypertensive number even as a young medical student. And, something's going on here. Then I went to my psychiatry residency at UC Irvine in Southern California, and my first mindfulness teacher was actually a faculty member, Roger Walsh, in my residency. And so I learned mindfulness as a psychiatric resident. And the idea of systematically cultivating self-awareness, situational awareness through mindfulness practice was enormously powerful for me, and that started me on my trail.
Now, you noticed the surprise in my voice. Hey, you're a doctor, a medical doctor. How did you come to mindfulness? The fact is that for most of human history, these practices are ancient, and this the idea that we are integrated, body, mind, and soul, was really the idea that we carried around with us. It's a relatively recent idea that somehow the body and mind are separate.
Yes. You know, we have the Western philosophy, you know, I think, therefore I am, and, you know, and we have the duality of the biological understanding of the body, and how do you incorporate the subjectivity of human experience? You know, but all of that is, as you say, it's very different from my limited understanding of the view of health and wholeness as human beings from ancient times.
Talk about those ancient philosophies and how far they go back and how many now inform the sort of new school of mindfulness that is now backed by a lot of research.
Yes. Well, in mindfulness, actually, of course, is a basic human capacity for awareness. And it's even the awareness of what our little ego mind might be demanding at the time and the situation of our body in reaction to that, the tension or the tightness. Mindfulness in a health setting was popularized by Jon Kabat-Zinn with the creation of mindfulness-based stress reduction. Now, John actually makes no bones about it. He draws on ancient Buddhist meditation instructions. Now, he's not drawing on Buddhist philosophy particularly, but the instructions that he uses are very simple to follow, and they help people tap into this capacity for self-awareness. And, of course, in the Buddhist world, it's well-developed, goes back, 2,500 years or whatever to the Buddhist teachings. But I've found, you look at different faith traditions, and most of them have some way. They don't always use the word mindfulness, but they do talk about awareness or being able to be sort of present and here, be still and know that I am God, that kind of idea in the Christian faith. Be still. Well, what needs to be still? Well, the body, but also maybe the busy ego mind, at least long enough so we can hear something more about the mystery of what it means to be human.
So it's interesting. You talk about the ego mind. You talk about mindfulness, but the body is going in one direction and all these voices. It can be important for us to see elements of ourselves and our behavior, and yet we talk about this, the importance of being integrated. So I want to take a break right now and come back and ask you about when we see ourselves as separately and then how you put it all back together again so we can integrate and move on. And I'll do that on The State of Things today with Dr. Jeffrey Brantley. He is director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke's Integrative Medicine. Just ahead, One Tar Heel's Path to Enlightenment on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest, Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke's Integrative Medicine, author of Calming Your Anxious Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Anxiety, Fear, and Panic. Also author of a series of books called 5 Good Minutes. 5 of those books are out as well. Let's talk a little bit about how you came to this. Now, you told us about your first encounter with mindfulness back in the 1970s. You were raised here in North Carolina, went to school at Carolina?
Yes.
So
yes.
Tell us about where you thought you were going when you went to med school.
I laugh. How do you know these things? I just came back from my 40th college reunion at Davidson, and it was a sweet thing, and it was like I wished I could go back and talk to me then from now and say, don't worry so much. It actually is going to turn out pretty good for most of us, And so I didn't know. I mean, I was in college. I didn't know what. I drifted around and finally decided to go to medical school. When I went to medical school at UNC, I was interested in really the human condition and kind of the human consciousness and a bigger picture. And so it was going to be family medicine or psychiatry. But when it came right down to it, after all was said and done, I felt like psychiatry gave me a chance to explore those questions more thoroughly. So I went to Irvine and trained in psychiatry and got interested. They got instructed in mindfulness and that. But then I practiced traditional psychiatry for like 18 years before the activities that turned into Duke Integrative Medicine arose in the 90s and after. So I'm in a position now that didn't even exist as a job even 15 years ago.
Were your parents religious or mystical or in any way interested in the kinds of things you do now?
Well, God bless them. They had their own way, but they were very careful not to push anything on either me or my sister. And I really am grateful for that. They did expose us to church. I was raised, went to the Southern Methodist Church and for years until when the time came that I had questions about it, they said, okay, you don't have to go, Mm-hmm. And so they really left me free. So they were wise-hearted that way, open-hearted about letting me find my own path,
Do you think now any of your religious training comes back into play, maybe albeit in a different way, in a different form?
Well, Frank, so I started out wondering because of all of that and I've inquired about a number of different faith traditions and worked with different teachers and different traditions over the years, including Christian contemplatives and Hindu spiritualists and Buddhist teachers and Native Americans. And I've kind of landed this stage in the game with the idea that it's all a beautiful mystery and there are many ways up the mountain, but they lead us to some kind of a place that all the mystics really speak about, of a sense of true belonging in a way.
You talked about practicing psychiatry through the 70s and 80s and then finding yourself in this position that didn't exist. Did you find yourself wishing for the position that you're in, or did it just open up and you were suddenly ready for it?
I probably don't have that good imagination. You know, I it was more of a sense of trying to work towards some direction. You know, and back in the day, we talked about healing models and ancient traditions and what were some of the elements that were missing in our current paradigm in Western allopathic medicine, and try to openly bring them forward. And so, I mentioned earlier the mindfulness, the awareness we knew was at the core for anybody to be the advocate for their own health and healing. So with those kind of compass directions, we just kept working away with the reality of, you know, the system that we're in. I mean, we don't view integrative medicine as a bunch of rebels. In fact, our directors have said, and I say, at some point, there isn't integrative medicine. It's just good medicine, taking advantage of all the evidence-based, mind and body, other paradigms, Western allopathic, all of that together to help each person flourish.
Well, the evidence is building now. There's a great amount of research that shows that you do change physiologically if you meditate, if you take time out. Can you talk about
some of it? Yes, absolutely. It's very exciting times, really. You know, 10, 15 years ago, there was some evidence. It wasn't nearly like now. So we've had evidence of people's reports of changes in their subjective experience of stress. That's sort of the first wave. In the last 10 years particularly, we have discovered that brainwave patterns change in ways that we like when people meditate. We've discovered that parts of the brain actually get thicker in areas that are supportive of, good things like empathy or cognitive function, executive function in people who meditate. Parts of the brain get thicker. And very recently, there's been papers published that show that our genomic stability, in other words, the chromosomes in our cells, are actually supported as they divide and replicate many times over their lifetime. They're supported and strengthened in people who meditate.
Well, I need to stop meditating, because if I get any thicker, the staff is going to throw me out of the meetings, I think. But I guess you're talking about thickness in terms of health, of robustness, of brain.
Well, I'm actually talking about more gray matter.
Wow.
They've got functional MRI scans. Amisha Jha and Sarah Lazar are a couple of the names, leaders in this area. Who have actually scanned the brains of meditators and non-meditators, and they find that certain parts of the brain in the meditators are thicker. They have more gray matter, which is, you know, the active brain cell, not the white matter that carries and protects insulates the signals.
So what do you think is going on there?
Well, nobody knows for sure, you know. Although one of the things, one of the buzzwords nowadays is neuroplasticity, which means really that the brain, this is Brantley's ignorant and distorted understanding of it, but the idea, as I understand it, is that the brain is now understood to function in a way similar to our muscles. In other words, how we use our muscles, they grow in the directions. So if you can get them to be fat and big, or wiry and strong, or a little bit of both, or not at all. If we don't use them, they wither. Well, the brain actually appears to be like that as well, that the circuits that arise in the brain, depending on how we use it and what we ask of it, they fire, and if they fire enough, they get stronger, and if they don't fire enough, they wither away. So it may be that somehow that signal is translated into actual neurogenesis, the growth of new brain cells.
Well, allowing for new possibilities, new pathways, new ways into and out of trouble for us all. Wait, are we talking now about only stress reduction? I feel a little stressed out. I'm a little jangled. Come see Doc Brantley and settle down. Or is there a relationship between other pathologies, other illnesses that can be related to the mind?
Yes. Well, there's a long literature about the relationship of stress to different illnesses. And I can't explain it all, but in simple terms, my understanding is that, you know, we each have vulnerabilities. So, for example, one might be vulnerable to diabetes. And one of the reactions of the body in the stress reaction is to make more blood sugar available, raise your blood sugar so the muscles have fuel to burn to fight or flight. Well, if the stress is unmanaged and is protracted over time, then that high blood sugar could increase the risk that some people would develop diabetes, for example. And you could make a similar case for hypertension or some kind of cardiac arrhythmias or a variety of conditions, including brain conditions like depression, where it's been shown that chronic stress may actually reduce the amount of important neurotransmitter serotonin in some people.
Do we have any idea how much chronic stress, how that has changed over time? And I don't know what time period you want to use, but certainly ancient ancestors endured stress. There were lots of bad things that would happen. It would come and go. The stuff would pass out of us. Is there any indication now that we're really living in times where we just can't make the stress stop? We're just in chronic stress.
Yes. Well, you know, I think there is a lot more input now for people. I get asked this question a lot, and what I've read and heard people say about it. Just for example, you know, the ancient, even 50 years ago, or heck, even 15 years ago, there wasn't an internet, you know? And before there wasn't television. I mean, you know, it's like, so the modern, the good side of the modern global network is one thing, but the downside is that if people choose to, they can stay tuned into a whole stream of information that's very stimulating. A lot of it can be upsetting. And every time, you know, what are the sources of stimulation? The news about terrorism or the economy or even a person's tragedy like the Joplin, Missouri and the tornadoes, it can activate that stress reaction in us. And if we don't give ourselves a chance to step back and pause and the body to recover, then we really continue to expose ourselves to the deleterious effects of chronic stress.
In doing that, though, in listening to the news and, in a sense, empathizing, I'm assuming that's a little bit of what's going on. I mean, we may worry about ourselves. What if the tornado hit me? What if the terrorist, you know, drops the bomb on my head? But the other side of it is we worry about other people. Compassion is also one of the things that you stress, this ancient idea. Why is that good for us, and how does it go bad when we're sort of watching the 24-hour news cycle?
You know, I'm not sure compassion actually goes bad. There was a popular phrase in the media, compassion fatigue. And, you know, it sort of reflects the idea that you or I, like we've seen enough of the tornado, we just switch the channel, you know. Or for healthcare providers, they don't go in the room with the person who's dying because there's nothing else they can do, and it just makes them feel too bad, and they can't go in there and feel, you know, like that. But it's pointed out by people wiser than me that compassion is an interactive thing. It comes up in relationship. It taps when we're tapped by our deepest human sense of caring about the other and the pain that we see. And so probably what happens, I think a more sophisticated or a deeper look at the idea of compassion fatigue, at least in my view, is that people actually get so burned out and kind of hardened by the distress they're carrying, the stress, chronic stress, that it's hard for a person to feel or connect with their natural capacity for caring about the other. It's like a shield or comes up, you know, to block us.
So we're actually disabling our ability to be compassionate because the stress level has gotten so high and we're not addressing that.
Yes, I think that makes more sense to me, actually.
Is it not coincidental, perhaps, that at the same time in Western history that this idea, the separation of body and mind arose and was embraced, that we also embrace the idea of the individual, the rugged individual, and that we are competitive, not cooperative? All of these things sort of arose at the same time.
Yes. Well, you know, that's all part of our wholeness, you know, the mystery of being human, I call it. And part of, I think, maturation, just like for a child, you know, the good enough parenting helps them see when they have to say no for a while and feel themselves as separate, and then they have to figure out a way to tolerate their separateness so they can play together. And, you know, it's a lesson I try to remind myself as a 62-year-old to keep that, you know, when I'm separate, when I'm feeling like I have to play together, like that. Yeah. Well, I think we're wired as humans for all of those layers. This is where I come back to the self-awareness and the mindfulness, you know, that we can mistakenly think we're only one of those narratives or hats, if you will, the competitive one. We can cultivate that through a life, and our whole world is seen that way. And we can learn to see it as just a filter we see the world through and move into a deeper sense of exploration about who we are in this life.
And is that part of, as I understand it, part of the mindfulness practice would be to see that you don't necessarily have to identify with every feeling that you feel and every insult that you've endured or perhaps every compliment. That doesn't necessarily have to be you that day.
Absolutely. In fact, we teach in the stress reduction class that one of the ways one learns to reduce and free themselves from the usual stress reactivity patterns is to see what the little story is they're telling themselves about whatever is happening and understand that we're not our thoughts. We don't have to argue with them or follow them. We can just, it's good enough just to notice them and then give ourselves a choice about whether we follow them or not.
You have a series of books that makes it seem that this stuff isn't really brain surgery to rewire your brain.
Right, thank goodness.
that it really is something that you can do. It doesn't require surgery necessarily. It doesn't require medicine, although those two things could be indicated, certainly. 5 Good Minutes. Tell us about that series.
Yes, the 5 Good Minutes books are, my publisher at New Harbinger, after Calming Your Anxious Mind, they ask, could you, partner with one here, Wendy Milstein, and the two of you, could you write a series of short mindfulness practices you could do in 5 minutes? And I thought about it. And I thought, well, what finally came to me was it's not about 5 minutes or 5 seconds. It's about the present moment. And you brought us back beautifully to the present moment at the opening of this show. The mind gets caught up in the idea of 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 5 years, but the present moment is where we live. And so all those practices are about developing the skills to come back to the present moment in different situations and be aware.
And you would do these on a daily basis. Well, let's take one for instance.
Oh, okay.
So River of Thoughts I just went to, and that may give us an idea of how this might work.
Okay. So, again, this notion, I just kind of read through. So our statement, some days our minds are cluttered with unwanted thoughts. Endless negative preoccupations and worries steal away our precious energy. We've been talking about this, how we get over-identified with the storyline and we lose touch with what's actually in front of our nose or inside of us, And so the mindfulness practice could be to actually stop and pay attention. And this one gives some particular concrete examples of once you realize the river of thoughts is something you can watch and it's not an identity or a permanent condition, then you might want to just practice letting go of some of those thoughts, So the suggestion here is you could imagine writing down, if you're having a worried thought about whatever it is, write it down and imagine tossing it into the river, say goodbye to it. So it's changing, using awareness and some intentionality to change our relationship to this inner flow of thoughts.
Now, look, it may sound silly. It may sound just too simple to say all I have to do is imagine bundling up these difficult thoughts and throwing them into the river. I'm just picturing that. Doc, I'm having a problem here. And you're saying sit down and picture yourself at the river's edge with a bundle of problems, throwing them in the drink.
Yeah, well, it's simple but not easy because what happens? So it starts with the awareness that you're actually stuck in the thoughts. And you step back and disentangle from that narrative, that usual narrative. Say, oh, wow, lots of thoughts. Thoughts about, whatever, my condition, my disease or whatever it is. So it's like, well, all right, what are my thoughts? So the writing down is a way of separating. In truth, we're not our thoughts, but we tend to believe we are our thoughts too often. And these kinds of practices can help us disentangle from that.
And it seems to me, too, that we don't give enough credit to how silly it was that we got ourselves into this bind. The fact is, if we think it's silly to throw the problems in the river, how'd you get those ideas? They're simply imaginings to begin with.
Yes.
So, I mean, is it hard for your patients to understand that they've actually imagined their way into it? They can imagine their way out.
And not hard. Again, it starts with awareness. And then whether you throw them in the river or you just let go of thinking about it, or you put your attention on something else. There are many methods. They all start with the awareness, But like I had a nurse once told me, I'm the kind of person that can see 99 patients in my clinic. I go home, beat myself up because I didn't see 100. She had awareness of that river of thoughts when she got home and how it was keeping her a prisoner and causing her suffering. But she needed some methods, some practices to help disentangle.
Another kind of mystical idea that works its way into these is faith, and that you have a take on as well. Something that, I mean, it's interesting because if you look at the miracles from any of the great teachers and mystics, they tend to be in the context of faith. It tends to be not about just the healing, but if you read them more deeply, you'll notice that something about faith, which means it's not the healer so much, but the patient who had a big part in this. And that seems to play a part in your meditation as well.
So I would say, you know, faith is, as we said here in the writing, faith is a concept that means different things to different people and really different contexts. You know, on some level, I think what we write here, faith means the understanding that life is a mystery, and living in the mystery is what life is all about. So there's a sense of somebody pointed out to me once, there's faith, there's blind faith, and there's realized faith. Blind faith would be like, you know, it's a certain way all the time, and I'm just looking around till I see it. And there's all kinds of stuff we could say about how that's not correct or a good strategy for most of the time. Realized faith, though, is like, well, what if I really think there's some kind of support out there, or there's some blessing in this life, and I'm just open to that, but I'm not too demanding or controlling about it. And then I actually have experiences that support that. And it's like, wow, maybe there is something to this. A sense of curiosity and skepticism as well.
We will pursue this as our conversation continues with Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, head of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachel. My guest, Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, co-founder of Duke's Integrative Medicine and the director of its mindfulness-based stress reduction plan, author of Calming Your Anxious Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Anxiety, Fear, and Panic. So tell us, who comes to the center? What kinds of why they decide to come?
Well, we have people come for all sorts of reasons, Frank. You know, people are really looking to get some kind of healing, something better out of their health and happiness. So it could be folks who are kind of noticing they're overweight or they're underweight or they're feeling stressed. We have people who might have life-threatening illness or even a terminal diagnosis, and everything in between. And what we try to do is help them, you know, personalize an approach to their situation that makes sense with the evidence from a variety of different perspectives.
Tell us more about the evidence when it comes to, you talked a little bit about what happens inside the brain for people who meditate. Has there been much research done on chronic illness, acute illnesses, and the effect of meditation, and whether or not it can be integrated, and whether or not insurance companies will start recognizing it?
All right. Well, I think insurance companies are being pushed to find cost-effective ways to reduce health system utilization. That's administrator talk for I'm optimistic going forward. In terms of what happens in the mind and body, we know the stress reaction. We talked earlier about that. And there's a growing body of data with increasingly sophisticated research methodology that shows that people who undertake particularly mindfulness approaches, but other things as well, there's yoga training and even other kinds of mental imagery work, but the one I know about is the mindfulness mostly, but that people actually impact the stress reaction in their body and its sustainability over time. So people with depression, for instance, have reported that their episodes of depression may or may not be as intense. Particularly mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression has found some of this. People with different kinds of pain conditions doing mindfulness-based stress reduction have reported and been found that their experience of the pain shifts in good ways. And, you know, and it goes on and on, really. And we talked earlier about some of the brain changes and now the genomic changes that people are beginning to report. So we're just at the tip of the iceberg.
Well, the genomic research is interesting. I wonder if you can talk about that, the idea that you can, in a sense, rewire your own genes to some extent if you can. You can change yourself at a very, very basic rate, not just feel a little better about your pain or understand your pain better. There are real genetic changes.
Yes, at a cellular level. And I'm just getting tuned into this, so it's probably, again, imperfect. And somewhat uninformed, a good everyday reference is a book called Stress Less by a woman named Thea, I think T-H-E-A, Singer. And as I understand, the basic notion is in our cells in our body, of course, we have our chromosomes. And you might remember they look like little sort of X or cross-shaped little figures. And on those chromosomes are our genes. Well, it's been discovered that at the tips of those chromosomes, very much like the tip of your shoelace, is a sequence of, peptides that provide some stability to the chromosome as it has to unravel and replicate so the cell can divide and then come back together. Well, it's those tips that get degraded over time, and they're called telomeres, and there's an enzyme called telomerase that helps restore them. But in the recent researches, and stress has been found to impact negatively on this restoration. Hmm. And actually, the length of the telomeres has been found, as I recall, to be a predictor about health and well-being. So it's a kind of a cutting edge in genomics and personalized medicine. Okay. It's been published very recently that people do an intensive meditation retreat actually had increased telomerase activity. So the enzyme got more robust, right. And by
extension, so the end of your shoelace is a little stronger and a little more
stronger,
tied together.
Right, the meditation, yeah.
So you're literally, when you're under stress, you're literally becoming unraveled.
That's exactly, you got it. That's right. And the meditation will help you keep from getting unraveled at the cellular level. Now, the researchers are quick to point out that, this is not predictor of cells, life and well-being doesn't correlate automatically with total life. I mean, a bus could hit you even if you meditate, or anything could happen. But your cellular health and life, the genomic level, seems to be positively impacted.
Well, it's just a pretty good indication that there's reason to pursue this further. And again, if insurance companies are worried about, not accessing the system, keeping you healthy would be something they think they'd want to pay for over time. You spend a lot of time now. You're working with people who come to you and usually stress-related problems, but you spent 20 years in the Durham mental health system before you did all that.
Yes.
Was that kind of like the same practice or just a much different look?
Well, I like to think it was good medicine, psychiatric medicine. I was practicing traditional psychiatry, for the most part, but I did try to bring, as I grew in my own meditation practice, I tried to bring meditative support for myself. And when people asked me about it, I even ran some groups, and did some training for staff and some of the patients I had around mindfulness during those years. But it was definitely more what you'd say a traditional model of, prescribing medications and consulting with treatment teams and like that.
And how is that different? And what's the blend? I mean, do you see one replacing the other or just a different balance of medication to different therapies, mindfulness therapies?
Actually, I think the mindfulness work we're doing now is good medicine for the psychiatric medicine for the 21st century. It doesn't mean like cardiology or any other kind of specialty medicine that goes away. But to come back to the fact that what can each person learn to do through awareness and self-compassion to care for their own health and how that magnifies any kind of external treatment recommendation or practice.
You said that transcendental meditation is different from mindfulness. How so?
Well, again, this is Brantley's particular perspective, but they have similarities. But my understanding is that, and some authorities differentiate them this way, the transcendental meditation is, at least the beginning levels, has to do with repeating a mantra or a phrase. And in mindfulness, and so the focus in a way is concentrating the attention, and then the benefits kind of come from that in a way, at least at the beginning level, my understanding. Now, mindfulness is about awareness and cultivating awareness in different contexts. So there's a point where the cultivation and strengthening of steady attention is crucial to mindfulness, but the mindfulness itself is about the awareness of what's happening, not so much about simply focusing on a phrase or a other object.
Now, you've had, as we said, some experience in all of this, and I understand that one of your first retreats, Santa Fe, and there's a story about your first meal after the Santa Fe retreat.
Oh, right. Yeah, so I didn't really have the words and didn't really know what had happened to me too well, but I knew after a week of meditation that I was more relaxed and clear, and and like that. And so I remember a group of us were driving back to the airport in Albuquerque, and we stopped in Santa Fe at this Mexican restaurant. And for years after that, whenever I'd go to Santa Fe, I was looking for that restaurant because it was the best Mexican lunch I'd ever had. And it took me a while to figure out. It was, I'm sure it was very good anyway, but my own kind of clarity and presence to be there with each bite and all the tastes and everything, to be mindful, right, is what tipped the scales and made that so memorable.
Now, I suppose people would be looking for some kind of mountaintop experience, just that, mm-hmm, this opening, this, mm-hmm, enlightenment to happen kind of once and for all. I'm guessing that that's not what you're preaching here.
Oh, well, you know, I don't even know if I'm preaching. I just encourage people to find out what they already know and can know. And I do take some wisdom from one of my teachers in the Buddhist tradition, Roshi Joan Halifax, and I think I'm with her. I remember she said one time, there's the slow road to enlightenment and the fast road, and I'm definitely on the slow road. But at the same time, and I come back to your five-second opening here, you know, it's the present moment is where we live and where our life happens. And to the extent I found that I could cultivate coming back to this moment and opening to what's here, then the richness and the beauty and the mystery of it all becomes more and more vibrant.
But it's not a single moment then, is it? It's a kind of mental hygiene that you have to practice on a daily basis or not?
I think what my understanding of what I'm practicing is I'm learning to let go of the habits of mind of inattention and distractedness and getting caught in those, you know, like we talked earlier, the greediness and the aversion and all the stuff that the ego mind gets caught up, right, in managing. It's okay, but we can get blinded by that, you know. And so the practicing of mindfulness helps us not be so blind.
You talked about the 5 Good Minutes series. You also now are about to publish a book called True Belonging, Mindful Practices to Help You Overcome Loneliness, Connect with Others, and Cultivate Happiness. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning that. It's just coming out now. It was just reviewed in Shambhala Sun in this latest edition. And what my co-author, Wendy Milstein, and I tried to do in that book is sort of make the point in both narrative and also meditative, you know, writing and practices that as human beings, we can be our own worst enemy in the sense that we can talk ourselves into feeling more alone and separate than we really are. I mean, just for a really practical, no matter how alone and separate I might feel, I'm breathing, and I'm breathing the same air you're breathing. And the cells in my body are acting metabolically, and the food I'm taking in came from somewhere, and people that care about me still care about me. And so there's layers and layers of interconnection and interdependence. But the little story that gets going in our minds makes us feel separate and leads to a lot of misery. And so what we try to do is illustrate that in many ways and offer some hopefully easy, accessible practices individuals could tap into using mindfulness and imagery and reclaim this sense of deep connection we all have.
How big a part do you think loneliness plays in many of the psychological, psychiatric, and perhaps even some of the chronic physical illnesses that we see in modern developed countries?
I think it plays a huge role. There's even a medical literature about this, you know, that people's health outcomes are not as good if they're isolated socially. And, you know, again, how much of that in some way is something that could actually be changed that they might be able to impact themselves? And that's what we're trying to point to.
But can you really? I mean, for an individual who feels so isolated and who's gotten themselves in this spiral, nobody loves me, I mean, I can imagine them saying, well, I don't care that I'm breathing your air. You know, right, nobody loves me. Right. Nobody cares. I never get a phone call.
So, you know, we went through this in the traditional psychiatry world. Many do it today. You know, it's like folks, friends, and therapists will say things, well, why don't you call these people? And then you get some reason not, you know. And so the mindfulness, I think, helps a person encourages self-compassion to actually listen to what they're telling themselves, to maybe have a chance to see something else, you know, another way to be in relationship. And it's possible they never experienced the kind of love that, you know, is idealized about connection. But, some of the exercises we talk about in nature. Many people, even if they don't feel connected with human beings, they feel some connection with animals or with nature, and we actually have some practices to help them start there It almost doesn't matter where you start, because we have what it takes as human beings to grow from wherever we can start.
Why do you think that matters at all? Why do you think loneliness is an issue? Why do you think connectedness is related to health outcomes and that we somehow need to be connected? Why don't we, yeah. I mean,
well, you know, there's evidence that we're wired with something. We have capacity in our brain called mirror neurons that, you know, we see the emotion in another and we feel in our own bodies that experience of emotion like anger or sadness or joy or whatever. And that we have parts of our brain that thicken and actually, according to the research, believed to be related to empathy that we feel with other people. Why does it matter? In loneliness, our thoughts are very powerful. So if I look out there and I wave at somebody and they don't wave back, and my mind tells me, well, see, you're just a jerk. Nobody likes you. You've got a lonely life. That thought will trigger the stress reaction in my body. And then that'll open the cascade to all the health implications of chronic stress just from that inner narrative being addicted or lost in the inner narrative of how lonely and how isolated I am.
Do they come back? You spend some time. You've practiced faithfully. I've been through all 5 books, and I've done one a day. Am I cured, or do I find these things pushing back? These old narratives want their place in
That's a great question. You know, that's the mystery and the challenge of being human, I think, that there is pain in this life, you know, and how it's not, how's life treating you? It's how are you treating life? So when, you know, the pain comes back or the old narrative comes back, I mean, some of these things are mighty deep in us. I might feel vulnerable and ineffective from something in the way back, and it still flares, you know, but to have compassion and awareness for myself in that moment of distress is hugely important to changing how I respond.
So do we have some advice just how to get started? 5 tips to a stress-free life?
All right.
The first time we've done it on this show. Come on now.
Well, the first tip is that you can't stop the stress, but you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf, you know? And it's not not the stress, but the stressor and how we tell ourselves about it, you know? So, again, we get back to this sense of awareness and the sense of self-compassion, kindness, equanimity, and strength and wisdom to help us face the inevitable challenges we have to face.
Take 5 minutes out every day, 10, 15 minutes every day just to sit and stare at the wall?
Well, not stare at the wall, but reflect on, just make room and awareness for your experience and meet it with compassion.
Thank you so much for being on the program today. Food for thought. And mindfulness. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley is the co-founder of Duke Integrative Medicine and head of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. His latest book, soon to be out, True Belonging, Mindful Practices to Help You Overcome Loneliness, Connect with Others, and Cultivate Happiness. That's coming out soon. The one he's already on the stands is Calming Your Anxious Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Anxiety, Fear, and Panic. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org or check us out on Facebook. State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados with help from Jeremy Loeb and Julia Cox. Anna Cassell is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.